On behalf of the Professional Baseball Strength and Conditioning Coaches Society, I'd like to welcome you to the PBSCCS podcast. I'm your host, Chris Messina. Before we dive into this episode, I just wanted to give a shout out to all of our all-star sponsors. These sponsors are not only sponsoring the podcast, but they'll also be sponsoring our virtual clinic coming up on October 7th. The sponsors are Garden of Life, Woodway, Direct Fitness Solutions, Momentous, Clean Athlete, and Active Pure. Again, I just wanted to say thank you for their support, and let's get into the episode. All right, everybody. So this episode of the podcast is going to be another group chat. I'm going to have the guys introduce themselves quickly, just their names, their current positions, how long they've been in pro ball, anything they really want to share with us quickly, and then we'll hop right into it. So Logan, we'll start with you. Guys, introduce yourselves, and we'll go from there.
I'm Logan Byman with the Pittsburgh Pirates. I am in the minor league system with the high A team in Bradenton. This will be my fifth year in pro ball. Definitely my most interesting so far.
Jordan, go ahead.
All right. Jordan Brown with the Tampa Bay Rays organization. Minor league strength coach going to Bowling Green, which is low A in the Midwest League. And this is my fourth year in pro ball.
All right. Hey, what's going on, fellas? Adam Knoll. I am with the Texas Rangers. I'm on my fifth year. I started off in AZL, rookie ball, did low A, high A last season. I'm going to go actually come back to Arizona and work again in rookie ball.
Awesome. And so today's discussion point, the big general topic that we're going to cover is speed training. So I'm excited to dive in with you guys. The first thing I really want to get into is just kind of a general discussion on speed training philosophy. Any volume guidelines or drills that you have that you've used with players in the past that have worked, and then any progressions along the way that you've seen good success with. So I think, Logan, if you kick us off, man, just your training philosophy on speed and anything you want to add in, and then we'll kind of just hop in as we go.
Yeah. I think to start it off, the first thing you have to decide for yourself or your organization is if it has any values. Why would you do it? For us, you have to run in every facet of your game. So especially as a position player, there's going to be value there. And then do you think that you can coach it? Do you think you can improve guys have the ability to get faster? If the answer to that is yes, then I think you're obligated at that point to make sure there is some form of speed training involved in the organization. You can get as deep into the weeds or as simple with it as you want to. I think for most coaches out there that are just trying to get started with it, the big thing to pay attention to is that doing something for it is better than doing nothing at all. It'll easily fit into an active warm-up type of setting where you can throw in drill work. I mean, a lot of us are comfortable with A-skips and some real foundational movements like that. It's an easy way to get yourself started. You can learn a ton from just looking into more information. I mean, a lot of great coaches out there. I know I've learned a lot from Brent Callaway and Victor Hall with Exos. You got Dan Paff, Lauren Seagraves, Charlie Francis. A lot of that information is going to be track and field related a lot of times. So you do have to peel back some layers as to what's feasible for you. You're not working with one guy or three guys at a time. You might have spring training setting, you have 150 guys. So you do have to be able to scale and figure out what works in your setting. The first thing to do is to get started, get your foot in the door, and you'll be amazed how much you'll start to pick up and how quickly you start to adapt your program where you see success and where you don't. Remembering that, the guys that we're working with from a speed idea are very, very low in the training age there. So the benefit is that you have a ton of room to make improvement with these guys. They've never seen it before. The downside is that what you're going to get from a mechanical standpoint when you start this is going to be horrific to watch. You have to kind of wade through that a little bit and just understand that it's going to get better as you keep working. So I think, you know, to give my two cents into it, starting with acceleration, it to me is the must. You can start linear, lateral acceleration, probably a combination of the two, especially from a baseball perspective. If you want to, top speed is great, stuff like that, but you have to accelerate properly in order to get to stop to top speed. So starting small, make sure their accelerations are good, to me is the starting point there. Like I said, A-skips are an easy way to coach it. And then you can obviously get into actually sprinting. Take video of guys and watch them, develop an eye so that you know what you're looking for. And then to me, I think the big four things you want to look for from a hierarchy perspective, position, is the guy in the right position, first of all. If they can do that, you start to look at their pattern, right? Our legs, arms moving in the correct fashion. Then you can start to get into power and frequency. And then I think seeing a lot of that stuff, coaches can simplify for themselves. If you feel uncomfortable looking at speed work and uncomfortable coaching it, relate it back to the weight room. We're all very comfortable in the weight room. We all understand sets, reps, all that kind of stuff with weight room. And then sometimes when we get out to the field, it gets a little more complex. You're not sure how many sprint reps do you run? How far do you run? What's your recovery time? You can relate the failures you're seeing or the mistakes you're seeing in a sprint pattern back to the weight room, right? If a guy's trying to run and he's crumbling on every step, you probably have a strength issue. So instead of saying, I don't know how to fix that sprint wise, fix it in the weight room and then continue to sprint him and you will see that quality improve. So I think, that's a good starting place for a lot of people. Obviously, you can get astronomically complex into this stuff, but don't bury yourself day one. Start out really, really simple. Pick three drills that are really impactful for guys and have them do them all the time. So that's what I would start people with, just to get your foot in the door.
So, any specific drills? I know you said A-skips, but anything else? You said pick three, maybe three of the simplest ones that you start with day one with guys that coaches are going to be able to see, because you've mentioned it here and when we had you on the podcast the first time one-on-one, like sometimes coaches aren't comfortable with seeing speed work as they are in the weight room. And, you know, if it gets too complex of a drill, then a lot of things could go missed that the athlete is doing or not doing.
Yeah, a couple little tricks, I guess. For me, marches, then A skips. If your guys can do it, bounding to me is far and away one of the best drills you can do. The problem is getting your guys to the point where they can do that is tough.
Yeah.
So in place of that, a lot of times you can do standing marches or standing switches, which is just a march done in place, but with a very quick switch and you remain standing with a pause position at the top. I think far and away the best drill you're ever going to have is sprinting. Just actually sprint. I recommend 10 yard sprints. The way that I go about coaching them is I try to coach my guys to have a perfect first step. And if I feel that the group can do that successfully, then we'll start talking about the second step. And then the third, and then the fourth. To me, four steps is, in pure acceleration, about as good as you're going to get with a field sport athlete. So that's as far as I'll ever take it. I'd still tell them to go hard through 10 because I want the effort. And then I want them to try to run fast. I want them to try hard to run fast. I think that's valuable. So for me, 10-yard sprints are a great way to start your acceleration. You can change their starting positions. You know, a lot of guys, when we talk about speed in baseball, immediately go to, well, you know, my steel break. Like, all right, fine, we'll do lateral acceleration. It's the same thing. You're just going laterally for your first step. So you're in some way orientating yourself into linear on your first step. After that, everything's the same. Now, there's an entire argument we can have about drop, step, crossover, all that stuff. I don't know if we want to get into that today because you could probably spend 3 hours on that. But regardless, your goal is to get your center of mass moving in the direction you want to go as quickly and efficiently as possible and turn it into a linear sprint as quickly as you can. I think another quick trick that might help some people. When you're looking at sprinting, like you were saying, it's tough sometimes to see things. So taking video, obviously a huge advantage. You can watch it later. You can slow it down. In person, the best way to look at that, for me at least, is I call it a waterfall start. So even if I'm running a spring training stretch of 65 guys, the first guy starts, runs 5 yards. Once he's gotten 5 yards, the next player will start their sprint. So the guys start on their own once they've been instructed on how it organizes itself. But it gives me the chance to see each guy's first 2 or 3 steps without other guys in the way. It makes the video really clean too. So hopefully those are a couple tips that can help some people out off the first bit.
I'm sure Joe Hughes likes how clean that looks also when you're running a stretch with that many people.
It's always real good when the one guy doesn't get it and starts when he's not supposed to. And you know. But other than that, once they've done it a few times, it actually starts to look pretty clean as long as you get it through everybody's head how it's supposed to function. Some guys get nervous, freak out, and start running.
For sure. Adam, Jordan, anything you guys want to add on to what Logan said?
I think what Logan was saying with the warm-up, that's kind of how I look at it also. It's just having those few drills in your warm-up to help teach and emphasize not only running mechanics and form, but also how to apply force on the ground. So he was talking about bounding. For us, like, we do A skips, we'll do high knees, and then we'll usually do a power skip for height. So we're trying to get guys to learn how to put force on the ground to propel themselves up. And then we'll do not a power skip, but more of a distance type of skip where they're learning to push out, cover more distance. So I think different drills like that really help emphasize applying force. In terms of, you know, sprinting and how, like, I like to structure it coming from a track background. I like to have a max effort day, a sub-maximal day, and then like technical work, which could be included in that max effort day. Low volume, high intensity for max effort work, higher volume with a lower intensity for sub-maximal work. And then technical work, it kind of going back to the warm-up and, you know, taking some of those elements in order to teach guys technique. So 10-yard starts is something that we do, but for them, we emphasize arm action. So yes, we want them to, you know, get a hard push off their front foot, but we also give them the cue to throw their hands back just so that they can understand how powerful that step needs to be. We also do things like stick runs, and then we experimented with hug runs also. So it takes the upper body out of it, and they're learning to self-organize with their lower body also. So those are some of the mechanics that we kind of use to help teach those guys how to run. And then for work to rest ratios, I mean, we can get into that, I guess, but max effort work with my guys, I try and keep it, you know, 1 to 4, 1 to 5, try and give them the most rest time if I'm looking for a higher intensity thing. Technique work, I leave honestly to our baseball coaches because that's their base running. So they're learning how to base run. They're learning their rundowns. They're learning how to, you know, take that turn, coming off first base and everything like that. So I kind of leave that for the coaches to do, but I'm still observing and seeing how they're running, how they're taking their angles and their turns and where they're stepping and things like that. And then any like sub max day is usually like accelerations, build ups, in and outs where they're learning to go at max effort and then kind of coast at that max effort speed. So we do a lot of different things. And then in season, you know, it's all about management for those position players and everything. Pitchers obviously are a little bit different. I don't know if you want to get into them just because of their throwing schedule and everything. They're kind of all over the place.
Adam, how about you? You got anything to add on top of that?
Yeah, I think you guys, I mean, you guys are both hitting it on the, you know, nail on the head. I think Logan, you said a lot of good things that I really agree with. Just because, like, I've done a lot of research, even through Exos, that, you know, 10-second difference. Nick Winkleman, he was actually here. He dropped down like a ton of knowledge. But I think the thing is keeping speed training as simple as possible. 100%. Is just like, don't be a drill collector. Like, don't just keep getting as many drills as you possibly can. For me, it's hammer the march, hammer the A skip. I know this is a huge exos drill, but the pop float skip or the quick skip is something that they kind of like hammer just with projection. And like literally, like if you just started out with those three, you're on the right track on working projection and working proper angles. And this is obviously talking first about acceleration, because I totally agree. You gotta work acceleration first, I believe, because that is going to be the most important aspect for baseball players. You're going to get the most buy-in probably. I think you just start there with acceleration in basic movement and basic exercises. So march for me, march, skip, pop, float, maybe a run in there or high knee action, but it's really just those three right there for me. Then I like to get obviously on the wall, thing, posture hold, a load and lift, and a one count. There, get them off the wall, start to load them if you can. So march, march to bound, march to run, and then start working your regular flat ground sprints. You know, and from there, working out the first step, second step, third step. And when Nick was in here, he was like, hey, man, first three steps, like hammer those steps and you're going to see a lot of progress. I love what Logan, you said about the waterfall starts. That's huge. Even when you're doing your drills, not even just those sprints, but even the drills themselves. If you're doing like band resistant stuff or partner resisted, have those guys do a waterfall start to see each and every single one of those guys. That would be my progression. March, skip, pop, float, on the wall, posture hold, load and lift, one count, and then going, doing some sprints. And for me too, for the sprint, I like to do in like a waterfall falling start. So starting with a falling start, just working basically, just getting some speed, work that first three steps. From there, I like to go from easy start to kind of some hard start. So I would move from standing up to on the ground. And I kind of got, this is more from Derek Hansen. He's a huge influence on me, especially from a start and sprint position. So starting from the ground. So start from a high push-up stance. You know, then you can start from a segmental push-up from all the way to the bottom and then kind of just work your way back up. Maybe some half kneeling, some base ceiling starts, then maybe some lateral half kneeling, lateral push-up starts into different positions and work from there. Obviously, you start getting a little bit more complex with that, seeing different positions and seeing if they can handle that. So that would be kind of my progression. I also do probably early off season looking at doing more hill sprints. That way you're decreasing the intensity of the sprint just from the natural aspect of them having to run up a hill rather than them running on a flat surface. If they run flat surface, obviously they're going to have a little bit more speed. So starting from incline on the hill, working maybe some sled sprints, and then eventually getting away from the sled and hitting all your sprints from an unweighted position.
No, so it sounds like everybody is in agreement to keep things simple with speed training for sure. Again, we mentioned it earlier, it seems that a lot of strength and conditioning coaches are very comfortable in the weight room and can cue the shit out of a squat or a deadlift, and then you get them out on the field and it's like, I saw this drill on Instagram, so it's got to be good. Instead of having those few drills that you all said, like, hey, these are my few drills. I've mastered what I look for in these. I mastered the cueing in these. And the language sounds like it's so much cleaner to the athletes, which if you tell an athlete to do a drill and they're like, why? And you're like, ooh, I saw this on Instagram and Tyreek Hill was doing it and he's fast, so it's got to be good. It's like, no, I'm not going to do that. But if you have, you know, we're doing this because we're looking for these shin angles or we're looking for this arm action or whatever it is, then it just comes out cleaner to the athlete and the athlete will buy in more than likely to those simple drills. So I my follow-up question to you guys is, and you all kind of mentioned doing drills in the warm-ups, and Jordan, you had gone into kind of splitting the days up. How frequently are you guys doing specific speed work? Are you accounting for like base running with your base running coordinators? Is it a flowing like, hey, if we run base running on Wednesday, we'll do speed Monday, Friday, or is it we do a little bit each day in the warm up in addition to our drills? Is there specific volumes you're trying to hit per day or per week? Just kind of diving into that a little bit more. And I know it depends on the season. If you're in season, off season, even spring training is different than like the actual like affiliate season. So we can kind of go into that as well too, just in season versus off season adjustments that you make for the speed and the communication you're having with your base running coordinators, but maybe start like in spring training going into the affiliate season and then how you differentiate that in the off season.
For spring training, we usually, it's really dependent on the baseball work that's going to go on. So they may base run like twice a week during spring training, if I'm not mistaken. All the other times we're honestly only doing short sprints or buildups. So like 10 yards, 20 yards. If we're doing buildups, we'll do build up for 30 and then they're going max effort for 10. During that time, we usually kind of just rotate those through so they're not doing the same thing twice. In season, the way I like to operate is kind of more by feel. I mean, those guys are obviously they practice before every game and they're playing every game. And then obviously league by league, the travel is different. So you kind of have to account for that. So generally what I did with position players is if we could base run like every other week, all those other weeks I can get, you know, two runs in, whether they're 20s or in and outs or even, you know, build-ups just to keep the volume low. During our off-season camps, because our numbers are so low, we're able to do more technique work and even overspeed training with them. So those stick runs we would do, and we had a schedule every day and we'd rotate through it. We would do wicket drills to work on form. We did overspeed training with the curve treadmills. So they would do a 10-second sprint and then we'd hop off and then the next group would go. So they'd have the rest built into the reps of everybody else doing it. So usually they'd get about a minute rest before getting into their next run. And then we had sleds. So one day we would do a heavy sled run. And then another day we would do a lighter sled run to kind of offset that. I'm trying to think of all the other stuff we used to do. So some things would be paired together and other things wouldn't be. So I think with the heavy sled runs, we'd pair that with the overspeed training just to kind of really hit home on that CNS. And then the next day would be like stick runs and the lighter sled pulls just to give them kind of an active rest day.
Gotcha. And Adam, you had brought up the hill sprints and the sled work as well. How much of that do you get to do during spring training and even during the season versus the off season?
Yeah. So the hill sprints, I guess that would be more part of their off season program kind of implemented in that, you know, cause it's obviously, it's going to be hard to find a hill. We don't have a hill here. We don't have one built in on our conditioning field. So we do have a ton of sleds. So that is something that we're able to do during spring training. And I think like one thing that I've started doing during the season was for my speed work and my technical stuff, you know, probably do it about twice a week was just utilizing bands, you know, because I think, hey, we all have bands at our affiliate that are at least those big super bands that we can maybe get two on a guy, partner up. Obviously, it's not totally ideal to do that, but it's like, hey man, if that's what you have for resistance, then that's what you have. So I would just hammer resisted march and some resisted high knees or resisted a run, some resisted march to resisted bounds, and then get them into doing some sprints. So that was kind of like a way with the band. It's nice because it takes away their body weight, it deloads them, so we can get some really good technique work out of that without like completely crushing them. And that would be like their warm up for that day, you know, cause we know how repetitive this gets, especially at the affiliates, that like, hey man, like today we're going to change it up. We're going to do speed training. We'll do a quick say 5 minute dynamic, and then right into the band work. Banded march, banded high knees, 5 to 10 yards, two sets, low volume, and then just get right into some sprints. And again, I would change up. I'm huge on variability with these guys, especially if, you know, my group, I was in high A, so they've been with me or they've been in our system for a little bit longer. So they were able to own those positions already. And we just change it up. When we do some sprints, maybe we do some cat mouse drills. Maybe we do some tennis ball drops. Maybe we just have them do some, you know, some push-up starts out of a lateral position, you know, just change it up. And again, 10 yards, 15 yards, 20 yards, probably max. And then just keeping the volume super low, you know, and if you can get some good quality sprints, 3, 4, then that's a win, you know, but mainly just hammering the technique aspect during the season. And then, you know, like what Jordan was saying, hey, do your base running once a week. And then that way, those other 2 days, you can hammer some good quality work with your guys. I will say this with spring training. I don't know your guys' thoughts on this, but we try to do – so beginning before minor league camp opened, we had 3 days designated to the weight room and 3 days for speed training. Now, obviously, the speed training volume had to be super low. We just kept a simple one-day acceleration, one-day max velocity, and one-day change of direction. Once camp was supposed to start and games were supposed to be played, we were going to move it to almost a consolidation of stress, where one station would be their speed work and the next station would be base running. So that way they're just hammering that volume, but obviously keeping things on our end low and just hammering the technique. And then that way it's almost a primer, then moving over to the base running. Because a lot of times we all know that the base running quality is not always great because you just have so many guys over there and they're just looking to get guys, you know, one after the next, go, go, go. Yeah, they're looking at their turns, but they're not really focused on their movement. So again, that's our time that we can hammer that on the front end and then, all right, hey, they're primed, they're ready to go. Throw them over to the base running. And then that way, the next couple of days, they're not doing any base running. They're doing other baseball specific.
Gotcha. And Logan, how about you? Thoughts on this?
Yeah, we're relatively similar. I guess we have a couple differences where, you know, last 2 years or so, we started trying to come up with volumes for what do those base running sessions in spring training look like. You know, I mean, it's like everybody's mentioned so far, you end up with, you know, 75 guys out there on one field and, you know, maybe you're running drills off of two bases. So how many reps are you really getting? And what we found is the guys are getting, I don't know, maybe 4 reps when they're out there. First two are probably not at a real high speed. So you're getting almost negligible high intensity work. So we started programming our volume, especially before games started, almost not accounting for any sort of volume out there. Just because there just wasn't enough for us to really formulate it into the volume that we were getting. Now, the benefit of that is that when you're out there, if you're out there for that activity, it's a great time to coach guys. They have so much free time. You pull them aside after a rep. Hey, remember we were talking about this in stretch. The reason I keep saying it is because you can't do it here. On your next one, think about, you know, the things we've been talking about. So you can, especially one-on-one, you can have some good impact on guys in those scenarios. And a lot of times it'll show them the carryover, which is going to improve your buy-in. I think the other important thing to remember is, you know, especially I work a lot with outfielders with our groups when we divide up. A lot of the drills they do are high intensity sprints. So, I mean, when they're working on turns, trying to go back into the gaps to get balls, even drills where they're trying to, you know, come in and pick a ball throw, you know, a lot of those sprints are high intensity. So again, being out there for those drills, one, you can get a little bit of a feel on how intense the efforts are and whether or not you need to account for that. And then you can also get an idea of, all right, you know, is what we're working on carrying over? Do I need to spend more time on a different drill? Can I pull this guy aside real quick and give him a coaching cue and see if we can get an immediate improvement in the actual drill on field itself? Because if you give a guy a cue as a strength coach on running mechanics or even if it's just intent and they have an immediate improvement on an in-game or in-sport effort, your buy-in's going to be huge. So it's like, he just actually made me better at what I'm paid to do. So it really bridges the gap between, oh, I'm not a sprinter, I'm a baseball player, and okay, maybe this stuff can actually help me a little bit. So for spring training, we do all of our stuff in stretch. It's been the time that we've had the best opportunity. We've also found that it allows us to prepare guys for the day really well. So we will do a very general active warm-up at the beginning, like everybody's talked about so far. Then we'll get into some technical work, whether that is a march, a skip. We're trying to get into some bounding stuff. I think the big thing to note about skips versus bounds is that skips are double contacts. Bounding is a single contact effort, and running is a single contact effort. So there's some context that we like from bounding. It's just tough from a technical standpoint. I know we've already mentioned some like skips for height or skips for distance, pop and floats. We've gone into some variations like that to try and bridge the gap between A skips and bounding. So I think those are also really useful tools to throw in there as well. It just depends on your group. We break it down. We started out just working on acceleration. It's pretty much all we cared about. We did linear acceleration, lateral acceleration, and then the third day was more of like a general movement day. We'd spend more time on some mobility work. Wouldn't really focus on the technique stuff, because I think the other thing you have to consider for these guys is that the technical aspect for them is very difficult. They don't understand it. They're trying to learn it. So from a central nervous system perspective, there's the value of how hard are they thinking and trying with what they're trying to do. So for us, giving them a psychological break one day every 3 days in spring training has been nice. It's given them the opportunity to be able to just run through stretch without constantly dragging over technique. So we started out with linear lateral acceleration and a movement day. Do that three times, run it three times again. You just continue that cycle. Now that our guys are decent at that, we've jumped into a linear acceleration day, a lateral acceleration day, a top speed or max velocity day, and a lateral push day, which is kind of like a shuffle variation. It's going to correlate more with like your change of direction, agility type work. You know, again, it depends on the level your guys are at and if you're able to justify why you're doing it. Our guys are decent at accelerations now as a whole. So for us, if you're now good at accelerating and you're reaching higher speeds, we need you to be able to run efficiently at those high speeds, if not for performance, for injury prevention. And then our lateral push came from change of direction, and then our secondary leads just weren't where we wanted them. So teaching guys, you know, if I can get you to cover more ground more efficiently on a secondary, and that allows you to take two bases instead of one, that's beneficial for you. Would you agree? And I mean, the obvious answer is yes. So this is our first time really working on that. So carryover wise, you know, we don't have a whole lot of information on that yet. When it gets to in season, I think these guys both hit on it. You have smaller groups, which is more beneficial for you. Coaching individual issues and being able to do more resisted work. We've found that that's a better time if we need to do wall drills with guys where we can get that in. Large setting wall drills in spring training, we tried them last year. I mean, we did them. It's just a little tough. You get guys standing around, hard to see too many guys in a row. Even the efficacy of, is your fence stable enough to hold up 60 guys trying to push it over at one time? And that actually becomes an issue with fences that we had. So in season is a better time for that resisted stuff. I know in large group settings, we tried some band resisted or partner resisted stuff. Buy-in is a huge factor. Guys just didn't really buy into it. And so the effort level on it was low. So obviously then the drill wasn't very effective. In season, you have smaller groups. You can make sure your buy-in is a little higher, which obviously improves the outcome. I think there's definitely a place for resisted work. I think teaching bounding, if you can use resistance, is massive. because it allows the guy to get into the lean that you want him to be in. He doesn't feel like he's going to fall. But that a lot that relies on the partner. If you're not giving them proper resistance, then you're wasting your time to an extent. And then off season,
is definitely not ideal. That, you know, sled is definitely the way to go with that.
Yes, 100%. And so, you know, like in season, we've found that we can use sleds, and it's been pretty good. Spring training wise, unless you can get some smaller groups, it's tough to run sleds with 60 guys at a time. It's just,
yeah, we don't even bother running sleds in spring training just because the group is so big.
Yeah, so it's just not the time. Now, we did do, or I personally programmed a lot of sled work for especially our runners over the off season. Our progression for that was, you know, a lot of 10-yard sled sprints. We then went into 10-yard contrast sprints, which for us, a contrast sprint would be running a 10-yard sprint with a sled, probably two of them, dumping the sled, and then you run one without the sled. It's going to give you a little bit to try to fight with the carryover of, can I get in those angles without the help of the resistance? We built that up into 20 yards contrast. When I get to 20 yards, I'll do the sled for one rep, and then two reps will be no sled. And then 30 yards or more, we're going non-sled. I think the hill is another great one. We do have a hill at our facility. Turfing-wise, it's a little dicey depending on time of day and how wet the ground is and all that kind of stuff. But a really cool way to get guys into a forward lean without them having to think about it is having them run up a hill. So I think there's value there. You're going to increase the output that's required on one leg just because of the increased weight, because they're going up a hill. But you do have the added benefit of them being in proper position. Your stride length is a little bit lower typically. Your frequency is probably going to be a little higher. But you're removing a lot of that hamstring issue that you can have with guys that run improperly. Now, that is not a completely solid rule there, because we have a hill and we watched a guy blow his hamstring on the hill. So it can be done. So don't think I have a hill, guys are safe completely. It's tough to have that conversation later on with some upper management. But ideally, a hill is going to provide you the opportunity to save some hamstrings. So I think there's a lot of great tools there. You know, as far as the, like, as you go through phases, like we all understand the phases of the season. When you build out a macro cycle, you get general physical preparedness, you got, you know, specific prep, pre-competition, spring training for us, and then you go into competition. And we all know how that correlates to a weight room perspective, where you're going to work on, you know, work capacity, strength, you probably get into some power, and then you're going to get into, you know, reactivity, probably continue to bounce back and forth with some power. Depending on the guy, the level the guy's at, you may have some strength work involved in there as well. I think the thing to remember is, again, that this speed stuff can parallel that really easily. So the first thing you're going to need, if a guy's had however long off, is some general work capacity. You're not just going to be like, hey, bud, max effort 10-yard sprints, good luck. You got to build them up with some work capacity. As they start to get more into that, you can add some resistance. You can do some hill sprints before you start flat ground stuff, which is going to build a little bit of the strength. It's going to continue to add to your work capacity. And then once you start getting towards spring training or later into the off season, you can start to build in some of those ground sprints, some of the contrast sprints, some of the free sprints when you're starting to work on power production. And now you've basically paralleled what you already know with what you're trying to add in. It doesn't have to be this whole different world that we've never been to before. It's the same stuff, right? You're still working the same qualities. You're just doing it on the field. So I think that's a huge thing to keep coming back to for a lot of strength coaches is, what quality do you want? Now, how do you get your drill work to mirror that quality? And then it's just strength training again.
No, it's a good way to put it, man. I had never really thought of that. I guess openly, subconsciously, I kind of do that with my own programming. Like, you don't want to just jump a guy into max effort accelerations before he's had some buildup work in his sprints. Like it was, I guess it was just intuitive, but it makes sense when you lay it out that way. I'm glad you bring up the hamstring. Obviously I feel bad for you guys. You never want to have a guy blow out, especially not on your hill. But that will kind of lead me into where I want to go to this next one. So, in the group chat that we had before this, we had brought up bringing up return to play protocols for lower limb issues, hamstring issues, whatever the case may be, and kind of how you guys are navigating those waters. And obviously I know it depends on the injury and it depends on the length of time, and even a hamstring could be a couple days versus a couple months. Like all of that is factored in, I'm sure, but just generally speaking, I think Adam was the one that had brought it up in the group chat, so maybe Adam, you can kind of kick us off with this on return to play protocols for speed work and just getting back into running with lower limb issues.
Yeah, so this is something I've been diving into. Again, kind of referring back to Derek Hansen. He had a talk, I think, with like the Professional Football Association strength coaches. His return to play from a hamstring is always starting with acceleration first, and then building out from there. So, say the guy he injured his right hamstring, his right leg. Starting off with your, again, going back to what your, to what our basic is, a march, a skip, high knees, and starting with a march, keeping the right leg extended. All right. And start doing a single leg march. And you know, with the injured leg straight, can he tolerate that load? And just, again, you're starting 5 to 10 yards. If that feels good, all right, double leg march, 10 yards. Okay. And if that feels good, let's do a skip. Let's progress that. Hey, let's do a single leg. Can you tolerate that load on that right leg? If yes, okay, go into the double. Going into now, hey, let's build up some load on some high knees. How does that feel? You look at 10, 15, 20 yards with high knees. If he feels good with that, you know, hey, then start progressing them. Maybe you go back to do the hill sprints, or maybe you just start and doing some easy falling starts. You know that with a falling start or with a rolling start, it's less stress on the hamstring, just because your body is naturally picking up inertia already or picking up speed. And you're not having to overcome just a static start position, which is a little bit more aggressive and energy cost. So, to me, I think a lot of times we want to jump and just have these guys go long to shore or build out these runs where they're running 40 to 50 to 60 yard. It may be sub max work, but it's still a lot of stress on the hamstring, especially if they're casting out. Overstriding, that's still putting a lot of stress on the hamstring, even if it is 60-70%. You know, work short to long, build that out. Again, hammer your marches, hammer your skips, and hammer your high knees. And once you can tolerate that, then you're going into your falling starts working 10 yards. Can you tolerate that? How's that feel? 15 yards, 20 yards, 30 yards. You start throwing in some tempo runs. If he likes that, if he can tolerate that, great. I'm a big believer, again, if acceleration is our progression to max velocity, then it should be our progression from an injury hamstring standpoint. Can they tolerate that? I know, too, that like if you're doing those marches, skips, and high knees, that you're taking the hamstring out of the equation and you're building up that tolerance. So I think that we can all get better, especially with our ATCs, of working from a short to long. And that's just kind of my thought process on that. I don't know what you guys got.
Pretty similar to what you have. I think it's important that we note that athletes are going to dictate our progression and what we do with them. So while we're communicating with ATCs, and, you know, that's kind of how we do things a little bit, we usually – just take them through our dynamic warm-up and just see how they feel during that as a real basic tool. I do like the single leg loading from that aspect, so that might be something that I try out and see how that works with them. But as long as they have pain-free range of motion, we can keep slowly progressing them. And, yeah, we usually start with some type of slow acceleration or build-up just to get them to open up a little bit and see how that feels. And I think one thing that I do that I need to change is, you know, usually when we're working with athletes, we always give them that generic percentage of what we want them to run at. And I think we need to kind of stop doing that and maybe go to more of a shortened RPE scale, whether it be a 1-5 scale or something like that. Because I feel like if you shorten the number, you're shortening the subjectivity of how hard they're supposed to go. So if you give them a 4 for their RPE, like, hey, I want you to feel really tired, but you'll be able to go again, as opposed to, you know, 75%, that's so much wiggle room you're giving the athlete to kind of guess it. All right, well, I don't really know what my 75% is, so let me just do this. I think if we do something like that, then you can really track and see how that athlete is progressing in their return to play protocol. And if there is something where they're not comfortable with, then, you know, okay, well, they're not comfortable with this, let's scale it back a little bit. So pretty similar to what you have, just changes that I would make with how I'd work with my ATCs and how I would present that information and what I want from that athlete.
You know, one thing too you hit on is those percentages. Like, you might be holding a guy back, or you might be progressing a guy too fast.
Exactly.
That constant communication also with that athlete. It's like, yeah, this is cool on paper, but man, you might be holding him back. Like, he might be recovering faster. Like, we can, hey, let's push a little bit. Let's, hey, 85 now, you know, because obviously these numbers are a lot harder than just being in the weight room. It is so subjective. But that's a huge point too, of like communicating with, like, all right, dude, like, how was 75%? Like, is this too easy? Like, is this, how's it feeling? You know, you could all, yeah, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah, I think, you know, to kind of pull off that, I mean, I think that you guys basically have the same philosophy that we have with it. I mean, one, getting with the ATs and figuring out what can we do today. I think a lot of times we end up in those scenarios where it's like, oh, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't do that. Well, what can we do is the first priority, trying to figure that out. Obviously, you want to return the guy, like, end goal-wise, so going straight to the other side. We want to return them at a higher level than what they came in at, because what they came in at got them hurt. Unless, obviously, you have some kind of acute injury where the guy, you know, broke his foot or something like that. But typically, if this, especially if it's a soft tissue injury, like, whatever capacity we had this guy at got him hurt. So we need a higher capacity to make sure that that doesn't happen again, because that's our end. I don't ever want to see this guy in rehab again. So especially for the same thing. So knowing that's the outcome, you know, what can we do? For us, the progression is pretty similar. We'll start them on a wall, not really going anywhere. We'll do positional holds. We'll do load and lift. We'll do switches. To me, the prowler, a lot of guys have prowlers, that just becomes a moving wall drill for me. So you have the guy loaded up.
Good way to look at it.
Arms are still up in front. We'll go marches. I don't really do skips with prowlers. We might go to bounds. Again, it depends on the injury and how much force you want him to put down. At the same time, you have the progression from in-place movements, in-place marches. You can even do in-place skips to moving. So moving marches, moving skips, pop and float, depending on, again, where is the injury, what's the tolerance. You can do some resisted work, which is, again, resisted work, hills, building up to free sprints, obviously, is your end goal. With the percentages, for buildups at least, one we've used is stepping over the ankle, stepping over mid-shin, step over the knee. That's going to naturally build a little bit of that progression. So if you know that your highest intensity for a lot of those guys is going to be stepping over the knee, we may not go there at first. It may just be over the ankle. That feels okay. All right, let's try a little bit higher, a little bit higher. Sprint-wise, I am with you guys where the percentages sometimes get dicey. I know I start guys lower and then try to figure out where I think they're at in their percentage. And then based off of that, I give them the next percentage. I'll also take times on where, however far they're sprinting. I want it to take you X amount of time. And I know that looks to me like it's your 60%. So, all right, if we want to go 70, let's cut it a little bit shorter. And that way we can control with a hard number how fast they're actually running. Again, there's wiggle room in that too. Did he start too fast and finish slow? Did he finish fast because he started too slow? You know, I mean, you have to, I think like Adam was saying, you have to have conversations with the athlete at all times during those scenarios of what are they feeling? What is it like? You know, they have to be able to dictate to you what they need, because you have the exercise menu and the tools and the traits that you need to develop. But they're going to dictate how fast you move through them, what they look like, what they feel like, all that different stuff. I think the other thing to mention while we're on rehab is you're going to get a lot of guys in baseball that have issues that are not lower body related in rehab, which is a sweet time where they have more free time to be able to address issues that they have going on that have nothing to do with their injury. So if we have a guy, center fielder, who has a shoulder issue and he's shut down from throwing, and for whatever reason, he's back at rehab. I mean, even if he had to have surgery, that we could get this dude a lot better at sprinting at this time. He doesn't have anything else to do. There's much lighter load on him. We can increase the load on his running mechanics, assuming that that arm is in a position where we can run him. But you can fix a lot of running mechanical issues or sprint issues when you have guys in rehab. So, you know, obviously the end goal is to get his arm back to health or whatever the injury happens to be. But it doesn't mean that's the only issue you can address. You have a time period where you can address as many issues for this guy as possible.
Yeah, no question. I mean, you can, when a guy gets injured, you get to coach again, you know, especially if you're at an affiliate and they're not going to send that guy back to Florida or Arizona. Like, you get the opportunity to coach and to help this guy legitimately, like, fix his running mechanics. Like, you have that time now. To fix whatever, again, like what we, however we failed him, to build that capacity or hit the proper angle so he's not stressing his hamstring. Gosh, there was something else that you hit on, but you know, this is why this is so critical for every strength coach to understand speed training. Like, this is the holy grail, right? Like, weight room, that's awesome. You know what I mean? Like, you have to build the engine, but this is how you become a coach, is understanding how to transfer that, because this is the specific stuff, right? I mean, that's cool and all, squatting, benching, whatever, like, power development you're doing in the weight room. But, like, at the end of the day, man, like, this is how you need to be able – this is the separator right here. And knowing that, too, on helping guys recover quicker – you said, like, hey, what can we do today? Like, being aggressive, man, like, get these guys back to playing quicker is going to be on how good you are as being a sprint coach or working with max velocity and acceleration mechanics. And I think, like, one thing to get better at this is going out and just doing it. We all lift. We all know how to squat because we go and squat. We all know how to do a bench press because we all bench press or whatever, right? So I think it's really important that all coaches need to find whatever that course is or whatever it may be, to, again, like, keeping it as simple as possible and just doing the drills, knowing how, and then applying that stuff, man. Applying it, getting in there, getting dirty. You're just going to raise your value if you can get guys to return faster and just clean up a little bit of technique. I know it's kind of going off topic with the hamstring stuff. I just want to reiterate, like, this is so important. I mean, the buy-in with coaches and athletes obviously is an important, man, like, 100%, like, that shouldn't even be a discussion. This is the separator right here. Obviously we're all on this talk right now because we are passionate about it. The strength in the weight room, there is no doubt that is important, but this right here, I feel like, is the separator.
I think there's two things you hit on right there that are huge. And one of them is, you know, we get really good at coaching weight room activities. I mean, obviously we love them, right? And we do them all the time. So, you know, adding stuff into your program where you sprint, take a video of yourself, look at it. It's also going to help you a ton when it comes to programming this stuff, right? Like, you walk in, you know, the first day that you were ever decided you're going to be a strength coach, right? And somebody was like, all right, you want to work on strengthening, you know, whatever area it is, and no idea how to program it. You're like, oh, let me check my, you know, whatever NSCA handbook and figure out, you know, what rep range that correlates to. Like, what you did is you did it to yourself, and then you figured out what worked, and then you started doing it with athletes, and you probably tweaked a little bit more. It's the same process with this stuff. Get out there, practice it, and all of a sudden you'll develop more coaching cues because you'll have more cues for yourself, and that'll allow you to reach more and more guys. You'll also understand what exercises feel like what, right? So if I have a guy and I'm working on power expression and I keep having him do marches and I don't understand why he's not getting any better at it. And then you do a march and you're like, well, I can't express any power in this. Well, yeah, 100%. But because you've done it now, you understand that. And now you know, all right, well, maybe we're going to go to a skip for height or a bound or whatever to work on that aspect of it. So I think playing around on yourself is massive. And then just the other piece of this is as close to an on-field like sport coach you're ever going to be as a strength coach. Because the running that they do with you is identical to the running that they will do on the field. It's not like you know, they put a glove on, they put a hat on, but it's the same, right? Squatting, we are training a quality. Anything in the weight room, we're training a quality. They're never going to have a barbell on their back at second base, right? So it's just a really cool way to be able to bridge a gap between yourself and position coaches and players and the actual sport.
Honestly, my favorite thing about it is just honestly when an athlete comes up and he goes, hey, how did that look? And, you know, that's the rewarding part for me because, you know, when I'm looking at guys running, I try and look at them from the side, from in front, from behind, from another angle. And, you know, that will help me pick up something. And usually I'll tell them, like, hey, this is what I'm seeing. Try this. And then they're more receptive to it. They're listening. And now they're more focused on doing that. And sometimes I tell them, look, yo, go slower and see how that feels just so you can get the feel for it. Because, you know, at the end of the day, this is motor learning, you know, obviously for us to, and they may not understand that. But the guys that are asking the questions, you can tell they want to be better sprinters. Those are the guys that are always asking, hey, what was my time to first base? I had that question millions of times, you know, during the season. So that's always the most rewarding aspect to me is when they're coming up to me and asking questions and, you know, I'm trying to help figure it out along with them to help them become better runners. And I think that should be every, you know, strength coach's goal, obviously. So,
I mean, I think you kind of hit on it there too. The other thing to remember is like, when we get a guy in and you get a guy, and I mean, you guys know the guy I'm talking about where it's like, this guy has got to get stronger, right? You say it, the coaches say it, everybody's on the same page. We get it. And then you inevitably get that coach like a week or two later that's like, well, is he strong now? Well, no, he's not strong yet. Like, we're working on it, but it takes time. It's the same with this stuff, right? It's like you do one speed session. You're like, well, I'm not running a 4.340, so I'm out.
Yeah, those are the same coaches that are asking about ladder drills for faster feet. So yeah. I get it.
Here's what you tell that guy. You know, look, listen. When it comes to this, and this is, I tell the athletes this too, because this can get so repetitive every day doing A skips, doing marches, right? It gets repetitive. I tell them, look, I can't get you fast. You're born with that, right? We know the guys. You're either fast or you're not. I can get you. I can't get you fast, but I can get you faster. Right. And then that's a huge difference. They when they hear that, it's like, okay, you know, like that's why, you know, hammering this stuff, making it repetitive and getting really good at the basics. And the other thing too is, it's going to take this takes time, man. I mean, this takes,
yeah.
I've seen progress with guys that, like I said, I had in rookie ball and then I had 3 years later in high A and they're totally different runners, but that took like 3 years and okay. Maybe a coach is like, yeah, that's not fast enough, but we know, man, these motor units, this muscle learning, it takes time, especially with sprinting.
I mean, I think you're right on. Like, the thing to remember too, though, is, you know, I don't know. And this might be me personally, and this might be a soapbox thing for me. I refuse to say that I can't make you faster, right? Or like fast, you know, like we always say like, oh, speed is either have it or you don't. Well, a lot of time, and don't get me wrong, everybody's got their genetic ceiling. You're not going to get any higher than
that. That's what I was going to say. I was like, I could definitely make you a more efficient runner. You know,
right. For sure you can do
that way. You can fix the speed part of it. But, you know, a lot of these guys were getting them at their ceiling to begin with.
Right. And sometimes you have those guys, but you also have the guys that come over that have no strength, therefore no power, therefore no elasticity, and therefore no speed. Now, to say that you're either fast or you're not, well, that kid might be fast. He just can't show you that he's fast. So sometimes these guys like, and you know, Ben Charrington actually had a cool comment the other day. It was like he made some mistakes. Actually, this was when he was with the Sox, about like defining a player and putting them in the box of what this player needed to be. So I've tried to go more on the approach of I'm going to give you as many physical qualities as I can give you as fast as I can give them to you. And then we'll see what you do with them, right? Because you could get a guy that has physical qualities and is the best baseball player we've ever seen. And then you also have the guy that has every physical quality in the book and cannot play ball, right? So, and then there you have your guys in the middle. So for us, it's been a lot of trying to, I'm not going to overpromise and tell you that everybody in our organization is going to be a sub four to first now because we're doing speed work. But I'm also not going to tell you that I can't take some guys that are, you know, speed is not a tool for them. And now it will become a tool because of one, the mechanical work, and two, the qualities that we're creating for them, whether that be, you know, sleds or weight room work or whatever. You know, we're building them through that progression. We're going to give them the ability to express speed, right? So if you say speed is a natural quality, they just may not have the ability to show it to you yet.
Exactly.
So we're going to try to give them that ability. I completely agree with the genetic ceiling. It's in there. We just don't know where the hell it is.
And to kind of walk that back a little bit, I think with those guys that we get from the Dominican who are 16, 17, 18 years old, and even some of those high school guys, those are the guys you can probably really clean up and you can get them faster so that they can get closer to their ceiling. But the guys that are, you know, are already in the system that are probably in that 23 to 26 range, they're probably already there. So those are the guys that we need to clean up mechanics with that can make them more efficient runners. So,
and even if they're not there, they probably don't have enough time, depending on their skill level, to really do a ton with it. So I agree with you. I think, one, if you can clean up mechanics, and the biggest benefit and selling point for us has been, you know, performance improvements are awesome. And everybody gets excited. Everybody loves them. But if you can decrease injury risk by improving mechanics, that alone is enough of a selling point for people to buy in.
Yeah.
Right. Your best ability is your durability. And if that's the case, then if I can keep you on the field, I afford you the opportunity to play longer and make more money.
All right, everybody, we're going to stop part one of the speed training group discussion there with Adam, Logan, and Jordan. There was a ton of really good information in this episode, but we're at over an hour now. So we're going to save the rest for part two. Three things that I took from the guys in this episode: pick a few drills and master those, let the athlete's current position dictate their progression, and understand that speed training can and should parallel your work in the weight room. Again, before we end the episode, I just want to give a shout out to all of our All-Star sponsors for sponsoring both the podcast and the virtual clinic on October 7th. Those sponsors include Garden of Life, Woodway, Direct Fitness Solutions, Momentous, Clean Athlete, and Active Pure. And make sure to check out the PBS CCS on Instagram or go to the NSCA website to learn more about our virtual clinic coming up on October 7th. With that being said, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll talk to you again on the next one.